there wasn't that many gigs. And I really, really wanted that job. Man, I even had an eviction notice at one point. Like, I could, it's in Vancouver, right? I moved to Vancouver just to go chase the jobs.
Right.
And, oh man, that was fun.
This is Nicholas Cabana, a talented animator who has helped establish studios like MPC and Rodeo Montreal. Nick has a long history with visual effects, but recently he took the leap into new, undiscovered territory of IP development. Since creating Clanosaurus, Nick's team has been reinventing the mold of how to create original content, and we're excited to dig deeper into their process.
Like, everybody had a phone on their desk, and you knew when you got a call, when someone got a call, they were probably getting canned or let go, unfortunately. Right. And then some of the animators would call each other just to mess with them. Yeah, yeah. And so you'd get a call, and you'd realize someone is, oh, you're such an asshole.
It's like sticking it to the big man, is it?
Yeah, 100% it is that. Because the old model is like, it's not working right now. The way we're doing it, it's like, here's a bunch of artists that know how to incubate IP, that know how to create entertainment that people want to consume, but have oftentimes been told, nah. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for joining us today, Nick.
My pleasure. I'm super stoked to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, before we address the elephant in the room, or should I say the dinosaurs?
The dinosaurs in the room, yeah.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, like, the basically your starting point for to where you are now. Obviously not go as far back as, like, student days, but do you remember your life as an animator before Clano?
Yeah. I mean, I can go back to student days, but it'll take, like, 2 seconds. I didn't know I was going to go into animation. Like, I wanted to be a filmmaker or a director, and I just fell into animation because at the time, I didn't really have a portfolio for live-action type stuff, and I was drawing all the time, so it just so happened that that's based on, like, my sketches and pictures and whatever. Like, they accepted me into the animation program, and I fell in love with it. Like, I was just, I feel like, a natural at that stuff, probably because I had, like, watched so many Disney flicks and and CGI type stuff at the time, like Jurassic Park. And I fell into animation. Then eventually I felt like I wasn't learning enough at university level. It was all like experimental. So so I went to Animation Mentor. That was phenomenal. That was in, oh my God, it's been forever, like 2009 for about almost 2 years. And then I got into, my first gig was at Sony, which was an insane experience. Yeah. And
was it the VFX wing or the?
Yeah, it was. So I started on Oz the Great and Powerful, which is not the best movie ever, but it was my first movie, so I'll always love it. And then eventually I did Smurfs, which was kind of like a hybrid. And at the time, everybody else was like ramping up, or they were either ramping down from Hotel Transylvania, or they were getting onto Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs too. Which was awesome to see. Like, I was so wide-eyed. I remember when I interviewed at Sony, I was like, oh my God, I was terrified. Like, I would, at the time, it was really hard to get the jobs. There wasn't that much work. Like, Marvel wasn't really the big thing yet, and Netflix wasn't around. And so there wasn't that many gigs. And I really, really wanted that job. Man, I even had an eviction notice at one point. Like, I could, it's in Vancouver, right? I moved to Vancouver just to go chase the jobs. And, oh man, that was fun. But anyways, I interviewed at Sony, and I remember, like, there was so much artwork in Sasha and Jeff Panko's office of Surf's Up. And I was, like, a huge Surf's Up fan. Yeah. Like, I love that movie. It's just vibes.
Yeah.
And I remember being so intimidated. I was, like, looking at all the artwork. I was like, oh my God, like, do I belong here?
Yeah.
And it felt like a fake it till you make it kind of like moment. And I didn't get the job, not right away, because at the time, I think it was a digital domain in Florida, sort of canceled the movie they were working on. And so all those animators, which were already working, were let go, and they were available to Sony. So they picked those guys up to work on, it was for Smurfs. And eventually Cloudy. And then I was like, oh my God, what do I do? Like, you know, I gotta pack up. Like, I can't even afford rent. And I had an offer from Singapore as well, which was to work on Odd Bods, which is now owned by.
Did you end up going to Singapore?
No, I almost did.
Okay, I
almost
I was
did.
Gonna say, I don't
so
remember
as
that.
As I'm booking the plane ticket, I've got the recruiter, she's amazing, still works at Sony, Samantha.
Oh, I know Samantha.
She's amazing. Yeah. And so she calls me and she's like, hey, do you want to come in for like another interview? I was like, are you serious? And she's like, yeah, for a different movie. It's VFX, Oz Again Powerful. And there might be a spot for you there. And I was like, oh my God, yeah. Like, she's like, when can you be there? I was like, I live 5 minutes away. I can be there like in 10 minutes. And that's what I did. Yeah. Literally, I think they booked the meeting the same day. I met, did you guys ever work with Troy?
No.
Troy Saliba? Well, he was supervising that film. I think now he's like at DNEG, mm-hmm. Running it over there. But so I went there. And this interview was really different. They already knew me, and it was kind of like, they were pitching the movie. I was in the screening room. They were showing me stuff that mm-hmm. we were going to work on. And that was that. The same week, I got an offer. And my life has been different ever since. And it's been a crazy adventure. Since then, I'll let you go. I feel like I'm talking a lot.
I remember that you even, like, were... like doing this little blog thing where you were like writing all your like,
yeah, you've been through that. Yeah. Oh, it's so cringe now. Like it's nice, right? Cause like
it's honestly super cute. It's, to see how excited you were.
I was, and so different now. Like you know, I've been influenced by like Marco and other people.
Okay.
Every now and then I catch myself being ever so slightly wide-eyed, but at the time I was like impressed by everything and I was just so bubbly about it all. Yeah. And then you realize, like, you know, sometimes it's very much just a job.
Yeah.
So it's you got to hold on to the magic. But I had that blog, and oh my God, I bet if I read through it nowadays, I'd be so embarrassed.
I haven't checked it lately. I think I checked it a couple years ago, actually.
if you post the link, I'll be so pissed off.
I will.
Anyway, it's funny. So I started on Oz, and eventually I got to work on Smurfs, which was the project that I didn't get hired for originally. Mm-hmm. And that team, I think it was like 127 animators on Smurfs. It was like one of the biggest teams at the time after John Carter. Mm-hmm. And I managed to be one of the last 11 people on that film as like a full junior. And at the time, like nowadays, like you'll get like armies of juniors getting hired.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At the time, I remember the first day I started, there was three juniors. Like it was the Sony was terrifying. It was just such a scary place to work at. Like they used to have these moments where like people never knew when they would. Nowadays you can have permanent contracts, you can have like contracts that are at least for a year or mm-hmm. 8 months, but back then it was like, hey, you're gonna work like 3 months and at some point we'll let you know if you're still working with us or not. Right, it was like super sporadic. And there used to be these days where people would get called, like everybody had a phone on their desk and you knew when you got a call, when someone got a call, they were probably getting canned or let go, unfortunately, because there wasn't that much work around.
Mm-hmm.
And there was these days where that would happen. And then some of the animators would call each other just to mess, just to fuck with them. Yeah, yeah. And so you'd get a call and you'd realize that someone is, oh, you're such an asshole. We were pricks back then, but I stayed on till the end of that, ended up working on like marketing stuff at the end. It was an amazing learning experience because in the marketing type work you got to go really fast. Mm-hmm. It feels a lot more like episodic, and then MPC and Framestore was opening up shop in Montreal at the time, which is where I'm from, and I never thought like the industry wasn't there. Mm-hmm. There was some stuff in Toronto, but it was all Vancouver and Los Angeles and London. And I was like, oh my God, like I maybe I'll be able to work back home on movies. And I loved the stuff that MPC was doing. At the time they were coming off of like Clash of Clans. Oh my God. Clash of the Titans.
Or, I don't remember.
Yeah. It's something like that. It was like this crazy VFX type work. Yeah. They were doing really, really cool shit. And Framestore as well. And I think Framestore was working on like Gravity at the time, and they were about to work on Paddington.
So you joined MPC right when it was starting out.
Here. Exactly. So it was unclear whether I was gonna stay at Sony, so I got an offer from MPC and I said yes, and I made my way back home. I had friends that were already working at Third Floor in Montreal. So a lot of companies were looking at Montreal because of the tax credits.
Wait, Third Floor, like the previous studio, Third
Floor?
Yeah, there was one here?
So when they were filming X-Men, Days of Future Past. They filmed it all in Montreal, and needed a pre-vis and post-vis department in-house at the filming studio, which was like the Mel studio. So I had some friends over there, and it was exciting because these were all friends from Vancouver that were all moving to Montreal. I was like, man, this is like home base for me. I want to do that. And I got into MPC, and where it was exciting is I was coming from Sony, which was like, you had maybe two to 300 animators in the entire studio, all working on different projects. MPC Montreal at the time, like I joined that company, there was 26 employees, like forget animators, 26 employees. A year and a half later, there was like 1200 people. It was nuts. But I got to open up shop there. And that was one of the best experiences of my life. MPC is a much different beast nowadays. But at the time, it was extremely intimate. It was an amazing learning experience for us because everybody was like in-house. Well, now after COVID, everyone's like working from home now. But at the time at the studio, it was exciting. We were like building this team, building this department. They had brought in some of the killers from London. There was Ben and Florent Limousin, who was one of the best VFX animators in the game. They were opening up that department in Montreal. And we got to work on X-Men and a few like amazing movies at the time. And it was still to this day, like one of the best experiences. It's where I met Marco, who I think that you just interviewed.
Yeah.
And we've been friends ever since. And MPC at the time was just a beautiful learning experience. And I've been lucky enough to be part of early teams a few times. And I think if you can do that, it's not always easy because there's like learning curves and sometimes the pipeline's not there. It's an amazing experience because everybody kind of like gets really close and everybody's kind of trying to like build something together rather than just being a cog.
Part of a wheel, yeah.
Yeah. And so I got to do that in the early days of MPC Montreal, and I got to do it again for Rodeo, which was awesome because Rodeo at the time we joined didn't really have an animation department. And eventually it became like an award-winning department, which was amazing. And building that with Yvon was awesome. It's exciting to be a part of something new, which is actually what I'm doing now.
Yeah. it all ties together.
we'll get into it later. But ever since I've been super, super fortunate in my career. Like I think it went really fast. I was pretty young at the time. I think I became a lead at like 26 or 27, which was really scary because like you're doing it for you're leading teams or people that may have more experience than you or be older. It's always a daunting experience, but you learn on the go and it kind of builds character and you learn leadership skills so I got to be a lead pretty early on in my career, and then I ended up being an animation supervisor for a little bit. So I supervised on stuff
At Framestore, correct?
No, I did it at Framestore, but I started at Rodeo. At Rodeo, I did Paddington 2, Fantastic Beasts 2, a lot of 2s. Yeah. I supervised on Game of Thrones, which I was a super. That's why I went to Rodeo. I was a super Game of Thrones nerd and fan. And so I did some of that. And
I'm surprised that you'd want to work on it because it gets spoiled a little bit, right?
Yeah, actually, that's so good that you say that because at first it sounded like a good idea. And then when I started working on it, I was like, fuck, I know everything that's going to happen. Like, this is not what I signed up for.
I told myself I would refuse it if it ever came my way because I was like, no.
And like, you know, you sign these aggressive NDAs. Of course, you're not going to tell anyone any spoilers, but holding it in is it's tough. It's a lot of responsibility. And we were working on season 7, not season 8, thankfully.
Yeah. Well, I guess I wouldn't have minded that one getting spoiled, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. It would have spared me the time. No offense to any artist that worked on it.
Yeah.
It's a great, great season, except for like the last couple episodes. Yeah. From the VFX POV, it's fantastic.
Yeah, the VFX is fantastic. I wanted to ask you because I remember back when we were, I guess, right at the time that you left Rodeo, I was joining.
It's true, yeah.
And I think I just missed you by like a month or something. But we still kind of hung out and we went out and stuff. And I remember you having a little bit of a gripe with how things were headed in the industry.
I think for me it was oftentimes like you would have like, let's say there's a lot of people that make decisions. from on the client side of things, you have many people that want to give their two cents. There's a lot of cooks in the kitchen, mm-hmm. right? And then and then let's say like the show gets distributed to a whole bunch of different vendors. Each of those vendors have their chain of command that then have to answer to the client. Mm-hmm. But then that whole process makes it inefficient, primarily because you deal with people at the top of the food chain that whose job doesn't make sense with the notes that they're giving. Like, you'll have animation supervisors who have studied motion, have studied how to make people feel something, mm-hmm. but they've got to answer to VFX soup. And sometimes you've got a great visual effects soup who understands the stuff or is hands-offish, and those are actually the best shows. But sometimes you have some that like want to see what's wrong in the shot or change the shot just to change it. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's always the case, but there's a lot of there's a lot of inefficiencies there, there's like a lot of back and forth,
like subjective stuff.
It's like, okay, I want the character to do a backflip, and it was doing a front flip before, and it's like, what does the audience feel? The audience is going to feel the exact same thing, and so I think that process kind of irked me really early on. I felt that a lot of money was being wasted on subjectivity and things that don't actually have impact for the audience. And that's mm-hmm. where the problem was, not to mention issues with pipeline and things like that. But I think that, the egos and the too many cooks in the kitchen was tough for me, where you'd have like a lot of notes coming from different streams. A lot of back and forth. You guys know this. Like you can do like 20 versions of the same shot, right? Mm-hmm. And then you look at all the versions. There's been situations where like supervisors will have like the clients or the director or the VFX director. Okay, you've asked for this many versions. You got to pick one. And they look at all of them. They're like, well, I can't pick one. They're all so similar.
What if you combined the fifth and the sixth?
And then you're like, exactly. They're all so similar. The audience is laughing. Great. It's done, right? And I think it's this whole kind of like ethos of overdoing it. It doesn't work. And there's a lot of, and for that reason, it's not always a profitable business, right? Especially for the VFX studios where they're a little bit held ransom to that mm-hmm. process of like the clients are going to order like a roast beef sandwich mm-hmm. and then they taste it and like, actually I want fried chicken instead. Right. Yeah. But I don't want to pay for a new menu. Yeah. Right. And that process to me felt like it was a race to the bottom. Mm-hmm. And I felt like there was just better ways of doing things. But I know that a lot of people feel that way, right? It's, you'll get like notes on a Friday because they'll only look at it on Friday, even though you've finished it on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And then there's this rush. Okay, we need to finish this through the weekend. You mm-hmm. submit it on Monday. Clients won't look at it until the Wednesday. And it's the same process over and over again. And there's like this feeling of like rushing for no reason, mm-hmm. and this feeling that like you can't have creative input, I think. And that part of it was definitely difficult.
Do you think most of that fell under like the production team side of things, or was it like a combination of?
It's everyone is kind of responsible for this. On the production side of things, their job is to try to make us all efficient, mm-hmm. and to actually try to push for approvals. But that in and of itself was an issue, in the sense that oftentimes the bid days that were approved, bid days meaning the amount of days you can like, where you're allowed to work on a shot, mm-hmm. were substantially less than like the reality of doing that shot. Like, let's say, you know, the animation supervisors will say, hey, when in the bidding process, they'll say, hey, this shot should probably take a good artist like 5 to 7 days. And production will slash those days in half and be like, no, it's like at 2 to 3 day, right? And then you'll spend 2 to 3 days. It looks like total shit. And then the clients are like, well, it doesn't look like what we wanted to. Well, of course, right? It's under bid.
Yeah.
And then you've got to do it over. And in the process of doing it over and over again, you've got diminishing returns. So it actually takes like 17 days to make the shot, right? Yeah. When it could have just easily taken 4 to 5 days if done mm-hmm. properly. And I think it's, and unfortunately, it's not necessarily getting better. It's only getting worse. It's definitely how I felt back then. I got to supervise work at Framestore, and the experience was amazing. I was really lucky with the clients that I had, I was really lucky with the visual effects supervisors, but it's not always the case. Like,
Yeah, such a like different world from even in this within the same studio from like client to client. It's really different.
Yeah.
Are there any of those things that you sort of take with you as you embark in this new journey of like creating your own studio?
Yeah. Yeah, I try to not be precious with things. And I think that was a part of the process as well that I realized wasn't working is everybody, and I think it's good, everybody wants to do their best work, but sometimes we're too precious about things that, and I feel like I'm going to get crucified for this, things that people won't see. They may not even feel it. And what I mean by that is a lot of times we'll spend thousands of dollars investing in places in a shot, specific sequence or shot that just doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. You know, and I would do this as an animation supervisor. My job was two things. It was quality control, but logical quality control, like mm-hmm. make sure we're not spending too much money as well as doing the best job that we can. But that also means like, where is the audience looking? They're looking right. at the main character. They don't give a shit what's happening in the background, like behind the character, mm-hmm. and there's fire all over the place and explosions and stuff like that. And I think oftentimes every department wants to do the best work, but it also means that we're investing too much in place in areas that don't make sense. And it's something we definitely try to bring at Klaino's, and now that like you know we're running our own studio as you call it, but it's so much more. Yeah. we'll get into it, but. Yeah, we look for places where we don't have to be precious. And in this day and age, nobody has attention spans. Mm-hmm. So I think it's about really focusing on what matters, what has the highest return on investment, and what actually has an impact for the audience, which is mostly, you know, it's what the main characters are doing. It's
storytelling.
It's the color language. It's the storytelling.
Hasn't it always been about story?
No, exactly. And and again, I know that, maybe what I'm saying is a little bit polarizing because what we're learning or what I'm coaching my team to do is to not care so much about like exactly what every finger is doing because it doesn't ultimately matter. And I don't want to take away from the art form, but there's places where it does matter. If we're making like a cinematic, maybe we'll be a little bit more fussy with quality. But ultimately, if we're making socials videos for, you know, Instagram or TikTok, mm-hmm. really what matters is like eye darts, eye direction, good posing. Mm-hmm. And episodic does this really well. It's like, what are the characters doing and how does the audience feel? Mm-hmm. And if making the fingers all pretty and polished and whatever actually does have impact for the audience, then we'll do it. Mm-hmm. But if we feel it doesn't, then there's not much reason to invest there yet. Yeah. And it makes us extremely efficient and extremely fast. And I think that's the right way of doing it. Yeah.
Interesting. So I want to go a little bit backwards and picture you in an office at Framestore working on VFX films. Was Framestore your last one? No, it was Scanline.
Scanline was my last one, yeah.
So you left Framestore to go to Scanline.
Leaving Framestore actually was one of the toughest decisions I've made. I love that place. And I think that of all the VFX studios I've worked at, Image Engine was a pretty positive experience, but that's because I was working on Jurassic Park and I'm like the biggest fan and I got to play around with Raptors. But Framestore, the team there is as good as it gets. Kyle, who's still running the department over there, is an incredible leader. And they love to do good work, and the creatures that they get to work on are awesome. And there was just a really good culture over there. So leaving there was a really tough decision. But at the time, and this was like in the middle of COVID and work from home, we had lost a little bit of sense of like community, mm-hmm. Which happens when everybody's working from home.
Yeah.
And you feel a little bit less loyal. It's just part of the game, right? And I had an offer from Scanline that it was very hard to refuse. Mm-hmm. So I went there, mm-hmm. For a little bit, where we were working on Rebel Moon, which got released not too long ago. It was mm-hmm. Zack Snyder's like version of Star Wars. and I worked there only for a little bit. So I was going to supervise there, but I think It just wasn't the environment for me. It was very hard to join a company in a work from home environment and feel that you have a place there. Mm-hmm. It was hard to join a company. At the time, they had just been consolidated by Netflix, mm-hmm. But they were still running off a pretty archaic pipeline. Oh my God, don't put this on camera. they didn't have the culture of animation that I was used to. Mm-hmm. And I had joined teams like that before. I had joined Rodeo that didn't have one, and we built it. And Rodeo had the ethos of, you guys make this special, and, right. and we'll empower you to do that. And that was an amazing thing. And so I've been in lean teams where they had built a department from the ground up. In this case, I just felt there was resistance. Mm-hmm. And if I'm hired from a place of having worked on all these creature shows and having led teams, what am I doing there if nobody's listening to me because I'm just the young guy that comes on the team? Mm-hmm. And so I just made the decision to leave Scanline. One of the few times I've ever left mid contracts, mm-hmm. But I did so to also work on
on the side. You were going kind of forward with Klaino, and it was kind of taking off.
Yeah, Klaino's was becoming very much a real thing. And I made the scariest decision to do that full time. I mean, simply put, it's been absolutely life changing. I couldn't have dreamed of where we are today. We've done so much. We just wrapped up our year one as a company, right? Officially.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And it's been a wild ride. I must have flown 30 times so far, mm-hmm. just whether it's for meetings or whatever. We've had conversations we never could have dreamed of, whether it's talking to some of the biggest toy companies in the world or studios.
This is an animator's dream come true.
Oh, it's crazy. It's it's so funny because in the last event in Amsterdam, we brought most of the animation team over. We flew everybody over to Amsterdam, and some of them hadn't been to the previous events, and I remember warning them, guys, you don't understand how crazy and awesome this is. People love this. They love Klaino's and come to these events. So we flew them out, and they were there at that huge event we hosted in Amsterdam. The venue was insane. It was a Cirque du Soleil-style venue. There was screens everywhere with Klaino's doing stuff. And I remember those animators coming up to me going oh my God. We premiered the cinematic mm-hmm. over there, and there was 1,200 people cheering at key moments of the cinematic. Grown adults cheering at key moments of the little boy puts the helmet on mm-hmm. the T-Rex, and everyone's woo, because to them they're okay, new collectibles are gonna come out, whatever. Yeah. But they're also very excited that, wow, I've helped them grow and look at what they're making now. It's almost Patreon meets Kickstarter on all sorts of steroids. But and I remember it was a very emotional, powerful thing for our animators, because they were there. They got to meet the fans, actual fans. It is nuts.
This is everyone sits at their desk at one point and thinks man, all this work, all these hours I'm putting into all these shows and all this stuff, all this investment of myself. Yeah. If only I was doing it for myself.
Yeah, and it's that feeling of
the proof that you can.
It's the feeling of, oh my God, we did that. Not only is it for me, but it also kind of belongs to a really emotionally invested community. Mm-hmm. And it's so special because it feels like you're building the product and the community is building it alongside you, and you've got super fandom, and it is the wildest experience. And for us as artists, it's been incredible to be kind of elevated by that community, but also get feedback from them, get whether it's ideas or things that might not be working, to test early products and things like that, and really start to build this thing into what it should and can be. And we really think that this is how you can properly incubate IP now, where you've got it's the next level of Patreons almost. Mm-hmm. And it's been an amazing journey for me and my team. And
are there things that you're like when you look back on how it all started and, you know, what you, where you are now on your after your first year, are there things that you are proud that you did a certain way? Are there things that you wish you did a little differently? Any kind of advice that you would give to people who are thinking of doing something similar?
Easy. I would say that, like, the toughest thing is learning the skills that you might not already have if you're an artist, right? Mm-hmm. Which is the business side of things, mm-hmm. whether it's financial management or taxes or mm-hmm. things like that, community management. Mm-hmm. So my advice there is definitely, like, you know, if you're building a sort of IP for yourself, understand where your gaps are and what you don't know. Mm-hmm. Get help from people you trust on the business side of things, mm-hmm. on financials, on whatever, and find people that have done this before, people that you know want you to succeed, and get advice from them. It's a whole different world, whether you're talking about licensing, distribution, things like that. You know, attend those expos. Licensing expo is actually free. You can just show up if you fly to Vegas or Europe or wherever they're hosting it. Mm-hmm. You can learn a lot there. What I would say is, what we're really building with Clanosaurs is this is sort of the, this is the proof of concept. It mm-hmm. will always be our baby. It will always be the flagship property. But as a studio, we're going to do more of these, and we're going to incubate more via Web3. We are going to do this for as many artists as we can, where we'll provide our knowledge, we'll house those new teams. They will retain the equity in their IP. You know, we'll share the load, and we will kind of repeat the process as it gets more and more figured out over the coming years. Mm-hmm. And essentially be a sort of IP and licensing powerhouse for the new digital age and new digital paradigms in, like, content production, whether it's content production for socials, content production for, like, longer form content, or whatever. Like, we're really onto something in how you can kind of, how an artist can take an idea and really go parabolic with it. And it's almost like a David and Goliath story where you don't need to go to distributors to beg them.
Right.
If you can be successful with the digital collectible side of things, and you can package your IP with fans, you can prepackage it with fans, it's a much easier conversation to then go to Amazon Prime or Netflix or whomever mm-hmm. and have a seat at the table and be listened to. Traditionally, most artists would have to, like, create an IP deck.
Yeah.
They would have to kind of, like, create their whole pitch and then knock on doors and hope.
Did you ever do a pitch? Did you ever create a pitch?
Well, nowadays we have one, but no. Actually, we had people knocking on our doors. That's where it's insane. Like, you have to understand it. And again, I really hope, I would beg for a lot of artists that are listening to this right now to understand that this is actually where it's heading. And no, NFTs are not dead. They're alive and well. And there's going to be a filter away from bad actors. Like, you know, it happens in every industry. But I would really beg for you guys to kind of understand that this is extremely empowering. You know, it's life-changing, but it allows you to hold control. Like you said, it allows you to retain royalties on your own work. Mm-hmm. What I would say is, you know, come up with your characters. Come up with something you've been working on for a long time. You know, whether you're doing it alone or building a small team, there's, like, you know, the traditional model is that you would, like you say, do a pitch package. Yeah. You would create these characters, and you would hope to talk to a distributor that would then undercut the crap out of you.
Yeah.
Because you have no leverage, right?
Right.
If you're trying to get leverage, incubate your characters or your IP online. You know, you can do it via socials, via, like, Instagram or TikTok or YouTube or whatever. Mm-hmm. But even that process is really tough, because if you're already working somewhere or you don't have time, like, it's
very time consuming.
A lot. And you're not making money off of that unless, like, your viewership is through the roof. Mm-hmm. However, if you kind of build digital collectibles around those characters and you properly curate community around those, mm-hmm. Essentially those patrons, mm-hmm. you can actually monetize the IP before it has story figured out, before it has long form productions or whatever. And because you've managed to monetize it, it then becomes a very different conversation when you are talking to potential distributors or people that might want to help you and all that fun stuff. It's very similar to what you guys would understand from like Kickstarter, but you don't build community on Kickstarter. Usually what happens is you get like, you get financed once, and that is where it ends. Yeah. And, you know, people have maybe paid for the product and then they'll wait until you develop the product. Mm-hmm. Versus this, you bootstrap via those digital collectibles. You curate a community that is holding those digital collectibles, and there's many things you can do with it, whether it's like feature them on content or reward early inclusion. You can reward via tokens. You can reward via cool items that can get airdropped into those digital collectibles. There's a lot that you can do with it. And you get brand loyalty, and you get brand ambassadors, and you get like a decentralized marketing army doing the work for you because they want you to win and they want the product to be known and out there because they essentially have some level of skin in the game. Mm-hmm. It's such a powerful thing. And like I said, this is like where it's all heading for sure. For sure it is. And just to put it in perspective, like, you know, the reason we're able to have these conversations is one, the product has to be good. Like, these things have to be cute. Yeah. People have to like them. You know, they've got to be aesthetically pleasing or appealing to some to some people. But the reality of it is, in our first year, we've generated over $60 million in secondary action just on the digital collectibles. We've done
Just on the NFTs.
And then in our first limited run of plushies, we generated $100,000 in the first 2 days. So it was a really successful run. And the market cap of our collections, our digital collections, is above $40 million US.
I have no idea what that means, but okay.
So the market cap,
like
the value of all the collectibles, if they were all to sell at the price that they are today, like on secondary market, like that's the value.
So when you picture baby Nick sitting at their desk animating on the Smurfs, and you look towards here, like, did you ever think this was going to be possible?
You know, it's so funny. Not necessarily, but I think deep down, I always kind of knew that I wasn't going to stay an animator forever. Like, I just had a feeling that there was like something more. Maybe it's because I wanted to be like a director when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I wasn't necessarily business savvy. I grew up around people that were, but I think for me, it's like, I was always curious about other things. And I felt like there has to be like more than just being a cog. Right. And I definitely had dreams of like building like a brand or IP.
I remember one day you texted me, it's like sticking it to the big man, is it?
Yeah, 100% it is that. Because the old model is like, it's not working right now. Everything is risky. Half the stuff doesn't stick. And the way we're doing it, it's like, here's a bunch of artists that know how to incubate IP, that know how to create entertainment that people want to consume, but have oftentimes been told, nah, like, you know, in the old model, because it costs so much money and there's so much risk to create fresh IP, it's the money people that are making a lot of decisions and are not allowing creative to do their jobs because there's so much risk.
Yeah.
Whereas what we're trying to do is we're saying, actually, the creatives know what they're doing. They have a innate sense for what audiences want. We can empower them to be as creative as they can be because they know what audiences want. And here's the proof. Like, the audience has spent $40 million on this in year one, right? Like, it's insane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And And in that sense, it is sticking it to the big guy. In that sense, it's giving all the power back to the artists that have been trained for years and years and years on how to build characters that people love and consume. And that's where we're taking this thing, is really empowering artists, is finding groups of artists that are sitting on their own IPs, and repeating that process for them as we attempt to become a digital native superpower for IP incubation.
The sky's the limit, man.
Oh, 100%. You know what's funny is I kind of wanted to say this before, but like, you know, you look at like what happened with the current I think it was Roadrunner, like Coyote and Roadrunner movie, right? That's like been shelved and then unshelved and whatever.
Yeah.
There's the amount of IPs that are sitting on shelves now that are either tax write-offs or it's too risky. Like, you finish 90% of the movie and you say, oh, I'm never going to release this movie. It's like, it's not worth the marketing cost.
Yeah.
We've actually been talking to studios that I won't name them, but you guys would know what these studios, who these studios are. They've come up to us and they're like, hey, we're sitting on IP doing nothing. It's picking up dust. It's a liability right now. Could you potentially repeat this model
with those characters
that have never seen the light of day, and it's too risky to release long form content around without testing the viability of it? And you know, we're not there yet, but just the fact that we're having those conversations, I think they're starting to understand that there is a lot of power in like community driven IP incubation, for sure.
Yeah. So. You make it sound really easy, and I do want to stress, like, you guys spend quite a bit of time developing these characters and making them look as good as they do. Right?
Yeah, 100%. Like, we had a bunch of crazy people that believed in doing this and believed that the risks that the rewards would outweigh the risks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we internally we built tons and tons of animation cycles. We built content before we had released, and we did it with a small team. But the reverse, like if you were to do long form content, you were gonna say, hey, I'm gonna make a short film with a bunch of friends. You would have done that. You would have maybe gone to a few awards. You wouldn't have monetized any of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you would hope that somebody notices this short film or whatever, or maybe it's a successful like Kickstarter short film, and hope that like distributors see it and hope that you retain some sort of power where you have like negotiating power, which you wouldn't have had, right?
Yeah, I remember one time I watched one of your talks that you did earlier. I don't remember with who or with what company, but you were mentioning that it was interesting when you were starting to put the team together, because the fact that it was an NFT that you were like sort of marketing it as. It wasn't like a big IP yet, right? It started out as just like the characters themselves.
Yeah.
You had people kind of turn down the idea just because it wasn't an NFT.
Oh, this is a good conversation. So I'll try to make it quick, but yeah, it was very hard to recruit specific artists in the beginning because of what people had heard about like NFTs and scams this and whatever, which by the way, it's not that. It's literally just digital assets.
Mm-hmm.
And we had rejections from people like, oh no, like I don't want to hear about it if it's NFTs. By the way, some of those same people have contacted
of
us
course.
Again. Like, oh, can you please like show me how you do this? And you know, now there's the writer's strike and there's no more work or whatever. And I'm not being facetious. Like, obviously, like we definitely entertain those conversations. But we've had artists from Pixar and DreamWorks actively call us and say, hey, like, could you guys are onto something, and maybe that's where it's all heading. Can you help us? And for sure, for us, the answer is like, of course. Like, of course we can start to entertain those talks, because that's what we plan on doing anyways, is really like repeating that process.
Mm-hmm.
But it's nice to be on the other side of it. At the beginning but you know, you think about this, and maybe this is going to make sense to everyone here that's like doubting.
Mm-hmm.
Think of the early days of Pixar, or even Netflix. that team was considered out of their minds. They were all considered basket cases. You had the entire 2D animation industry wanting to crucify those people and saying that this is like, it's like an insult to traditional animation. They're like, it's crazy talk. You can't make animation on a computer. Mm-hmm. And they saw the future. They felt that's where it was heading. A few years later, Disney acquires them for the technology and those minds. Mm-hmm. Same with Netflix. The whole film industry was like, this is like, this will never, like, they were laughing and openly, like, willingly licensing their films to Netflix as Netflix was sending out, like, mail order DVDs to people. And eventually you can stream online. Mm-hmm. But Netflix changed everything. Everything. Unfortunately, it started the ticking time bomb of where we are today. Yeah. But the point is, change and innovation is always seen with pitchforks and torches. Always. And a lot of times it comes from not understanding or not having the vision of where that industry
it's almost
going.
Like if somebody points a pitchfork at you, you're headed in the right direction.
Maybe.
Like
you're
probably onto something.
Yeah, but it's how we're feeling now because two years later, it's now we're having the conversations with the right parties. Now we're having conversations with artists that were extremely against NFTs in the beginning. And now we're like, okay, hang on. You guys are valid people. Like, you know, you've all been supervisors or you've helped build minions or whatever, right? And you know, we have a pretty stacked team. And our hopes was that our credentials would help bring some validity and credibility to that space. Mm-hmm. And if we're in it, we were pretty, well, look, we were confident in the product. We love these things. We love these little dinosaurs. But we also were confident in the fact that if people already know us and they know that we're good actors, they're going to ask questions as to why we're doing this. And the more successful we are at it, especially in the ecosystem where the industry is kind of falling apart, the more likely it is for people to start asking the right questions and start kind of opening their minds to the possibility that this might actually be the right way of doing things or the new way of doing things. And that is honestly what's happening now with a lot of artists contacting us and being like, hey, like, okay, maybe I was wrong and maybe there's something here.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful thing. And we knew early on that it was going to be polarized. And like you said, there's going to be the pitchforks and torches. And that's just a part of the process. And like you say, it kind of makes me bullish. It's like, okay, they hate us because they ain't us.
Yeah.
It's you know, we're exploring this new paradigm and hopefully we'll kind of pave the way for a lot of artists to be empowered to do it for themselves. And if they don't understand it, they can always call me or email me or email us. We'd love to incubate all your IP. But yeah, it's been a wild ride for sure.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us, Nick.
Thanks for listening to my weird tinfoil hat kind of like crypto tech speech. But I promise you this will make sense in a year or two. Yeah. It'll make a lot of sense for sure.
It's starting to click in my mind, hopefully in the rest of the world as well.
I'm not the best at explaining it. It's usually on the biz side of things. Yeah. But I'm very excited for the future. You know, we're in our final stages of fundraising and we're in early discussions for like licensing these things out. And it's been a wild ride.
Thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.